The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to The How of Business with Henry Lopez and David Begin, the podcast that helps you start, run, and grow your small business. And now, here are your hosts.
This is Henry Lopez, and welcome to this episode of The How of Business. My guest today is Andy Paul. Andy, welcome to the show.
Henry, thank you for having me.
Looking forward to this conversation. We're going to chat about Andy's journey, how he got to where he is today a little bit. But then we're going to dive in pretty quickly into improving B2B, so business-to-business sales for entrepreneurs and small business owners. If you want to receive more information about the How of Business, including links to the show notes page for this episode, just text the word biz, B-I-Z, to 31996. So let me tell you about Andy. Andy Paul is an author, a speaker, a sales acceleration strategist, a podcaster, and a highly experienced sales professional. He's been at it for quite some time, as will become evident as I tell
I'm old.
Exactly. We're both old. We've been around for a while. I've seen some things. Andy is the host of his own top-rated podcast. It's entitled Accelerate with Andy Paul. And that shows he's been educating and inspiring sales professionals to take their expertise to the next level. Andy is number 8 on LinkedIn's list of top 50 global sales experts, where over 166,000 professionals follow his daily posts on sales. He is also the author of 2 amazing Amazon best-selling books, as well as the founder of The Sales House. That's his latest venture, The Sales House, which is the first all-in-one modern personal growth program for modern B2B sellers. And that point of being modern is something we're going to get into about really a lot of what has changed from the traditional approach to sales. Andy, you live in New York City and in San Diego, right? You have residences both places, is that correct?
I do, that's correct. I'm in New York City today.
Wonderful, I love that. So Andy Paul, once again, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you, Henry.
So let's get started a little bit at the beginning. I'm always interested. You studied history at Stanford, and so immediately my question is, how did you end up in sales?
Yeah, it's sort of the accidental salesperson like a lot of people.
I was, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, well, I graduated and had a job lined up for the summer after graduation, but didn't have any long-term plans. And finally, I had a choice between the university offered me a job. And I thought, well, yeah, I should look at alternatives. So I went to the Career Placement Center, and there was a ad for a job for Burroughs, which, if, you know, if you remember Burroughs, was at the time was number 2 computer company in the world. And went and interviewed and got that job and decided I'd get away from the academic environment and go sell, having no idea what I was getting myself into.
When you were studying history, or when you decided to go to college to study history, where were you thinking that was going to take you?
That's what my dad said. Yeah, I had no idea. I mean, I really didn't. I didn't really envision, you know, being a lawyer, you know, anything like that. It's just got that classic liberal arts education.
Yeah, no doubt. I understand. Now, so when was your stint at JCPenney's selling shoes? Was that during school or
what? That was actually during high school.
High school. Interesting.
Yeah. So Madison, Wisconsin, working for JCPenney. So basically a holiday person. I sort of started in November and ended in, I don't know, February or something. But yeah, that was quite an experience, because I was 16-year-old kid helping women put their feet into shoes, and you know, there's a sort of just a level of intimacy about that for a young person was a little weird at first. But
imagine, were you any good at it?
Well, who knows, right? I mean, people came because they wanted to buy. I mean, people weren't really coming to JCPenney. My first day on the job, actually, I left home at like 8:30 to go to the store. I remember my parents are on the front stoop waving goodbye to me. And you know, cause I was the youngest of 4 and you know, off to my first job. But I remember my boss, when I showed up, he says, make sure you come here. He said that before I had started, he said, make sure you come the first day at 8:30. Store opens at 9. Yeah, I'll show you around this warehouse. And then, you know, give me 10 minutes. I'll teach you how to become the best salesman in the world. So he thought it only took 10 minutes to become really good at it. But
is that right?
Yeah, it was fun.
Did you learn anything selling shoes that you think still applies today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. I talk about this when I present to groups, is that, and this is not be stereotypical or so on, but I took the lessons that he taught me about how to use that Brannock foot measuring device that's in every shoe store in the world. I'd carefully measure a woman's foot, and I'd walk around the floor and pick out styles. And invariably they wanted a style in a different size than what they measured. And this is not atypical. We all know certain shoes fit different ways and so on. I'm an 11 in a running shoe and a 10 in a dress shoe or whatever, but I was a little sort of taken aback at this first, because I sort of kept trying to convince them that, well, no, you measure this, I should get... And it finally sort of dawned on me at the end of the first day. It was like, yeah, it's not really about what I want. Mm-hmm. It's about what the customer wants.
Right.
And that really has stuck with me.
Yeah, that's such a great takeaway. All right, and then I don't know if this was at Burroughs, but you say, quote, I was not a typical salesperson. I'm a bit of an introvert. My first employer didn't think I'd ever succeed because they believed I was too analytical, close quote. Tell me about that.
Well, so at Burroughs at the time, is after you'd been on board for a couple of weeks, they had this, the whole point was to weed people out, right? They hired a lot of college grads, and they had all these tests to try to weed you out. And one of them was you had to sell, at that time, they were still selling these desktop adding machines that were outdated at the time, because as you could get handheld calculators for substantially less, but we're out selling these to business. And so your first sales class you went to, you've been on board for about 2 weeks. They send you the sales class for 2 weeks and away from home. And we're, in my case, it's down Pasadena, California. And when you come back with this evaluation and a sealed envelope from the instructor of the class. Huh. And yeah, I dutifully come back to the office after my 2 weeks away, hand it to my branch manager, and I go back into the bullpen and start deciding what I'm going to do. And he comes and gets me and takes me back to his office, and he's looking at the evaluation. He says, so how do you think you did? I said, well, I thought I did pretty well. He goes, that's funny, because your instructor thinks we should fire you. And first thought is, oh my gosh, what am I going to tell my parents? And fired after 2 weeks on the job. And I said, what? He says, the instructor thinks you're too analytical. And at that time, just to give you a sense of selling, I mean, they wanted the extrovert, the hail fellow, well-met type thing, more stereotypical used car sales. And that just wasn't me. And I made up my mind fairly quickly when I got back to the office after training and went out and started beating my head against the wall, making cold calls, that, perhaps there's a way to do this that was more in tune with who I was as a person as opposed to the process they had set up.
Right.
That was really the path. I looked at the guys in the office that were doing well, and one of them in particular was sort of like me, and very service oriented, very analytical, not an extrovert at all. And I just shadowed him and learned what he was doing, and said, okay, well, some of that would make sense for me, and others, just being true to myself. There's other ways I'd put myself out there than what people did. I'd perhaps less pure cold calling. I did a lot of seminars in our branch that I invited people to, that I'd harvest prospects out of.
Mm-hmm. And so were you able to keep your job because you started producing in fairly short order? Why did your boss give you a break there and not fire you?
Because first of all, I'm laughing because he had only ever hired kids that come out of college with undergraduate business degrees.
I see.
He had never hired a history major.
Mm-hmm.
And he also thought, since his stereotype about people went to Stanford was, oh, they want to go be a lawyer or something, and so I'll never stay. And wasn't in my mind at all. So I found a way, and found a way that's sort of the basis of what I continued to do for decades, and succeeded very, very quickly. So I actually ended up getting promoted very quickly.
Yeah.
So, going to President's Club does that.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. All right. And then you went on to, I'm sure, various positions, but tell me a little bit briefly about that career path that led to then you starting your first consulting firm. Yeah.
Well, I left Burroughs because it was right about the time when personal computers were coming out. And I really had this epiphany moment where I was working with one of my salespeople to close this quite large deal. In today's dollars, it would have been a couple $100,000. And I had confirmed with the owner of the company that he was going to buy the system from us. And we'd come down the next morning to get the contract signed. And we show up the next morning and he said, you know, that's some bad news, is that we're not going to be able to order this from you, because it turns around and points at this credenza behind his desk and there's this Apple II sitting there.
Oh my.
And he says, because I was at a computer store last night and they said this computer will for $2,000 do everything your, you know, multi-$1,000 system will do, which was not in the slightest true at that time. But the Apple had just gotten disk drives. But yeah, for me that was like, oh, okay, that's not the last time that's going to happen. Right. And so I went back to the office and called a friend who had actually worked with me at Burroughs and had since gotten a job at Apple and said, so what's going on down there? And so that got me into Apple in the early days, pre-Mac days. And I was responsible for marketing Apples to small and mid-sized businesses. And that sort of got me into the startup world at that point. I got recruited to go to a startup that made the first battery-powered laptop computer, and then another stop in the PC business, and then transitioned into the wireless and satellite communications world, which I did for about 15 years before starting my own company, where basically traveled the world, ran sales teams, you know, covering the world, selling, you know, multi-million-dollar satellite communication systems. And what's really interesting is because we were selling these for these really mission-critical systems, working for small companies with no brand name, no track record, competing against some of the biggest companies in the world, selling to some of the biggest companies in the world. And that sort of became my niche and my expertise, where I joined companies to help them do that.
Mm-hmm. And so then that shift to help others develop that proficiency, why did you decide to do that?
Well, a combination of things. One is I was sort of burnt out after traveling as much. And I missed my first birthday for one of the kids on a trip. And I just decided, I wasn't going to let that happen again. And so a combination of that and with the company I was with at the time, I was part of a team that had put together a fairly sizable acquisition of another company that was based in Atlanta. And the plan would have been for me to go to Atlanta at that time from San Diego. And that wasn't going to happen. So from the family front. So just a combination of things that made it the right time.
Yeah. What do you miss most about being, about carrying a bag, about being in sales? What do you miss? I know you're doing some level of it now, but
sure.
What do you miss the most about it?
Just learning about what companies do and the people who work there. I mean, that for me, that was always, I think, maybe one of the driving things for me in sales is just sort of this, you know, insatiable curiosity about companies and what they do and who they sell to and the people that work at these companies. And it was, that's what made it interesting to get on a plane and travel somewhere to do business. I mean, it was obviously the travel wasn't any fun, but being there was a lot of fun. And that's always what I sort of told people is, the travel, if you could put that out of your mind, the international business or traveling all over the country, dealing with customers, once you're there meeting them, that's a lot of fun because you learn so much.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I think that was one of the things I enjoyed the most about it as well, Andy, is you just that new challenge, right? You weren't stuck somewhere doing the same thing. You went to somebody else's business and you learned. And fortunately, if you're any good at it, you have the ability to very quickly figure out, okay, you guys are doing it this way and here's how I'm going to recommend you do it differently. So you buy my stuff, but you're learning about this whole new environment. And so it's always something different. It's always a new challenge.
Yeah. And I think the important thing for anybody in that situation, whether you're an entrepreneur or solopreneur or whatever, is that, people are sort of going to have similar challenges, but you can't close yourself off to the fact that theirs is a unique situation and you have to be able to treat it uniquely. And this is, I think, one of the hard things is in sales these days and for a lot of companies is you want to set up your process and you say, okay, we identify a persona that we sell to within that company with these needs, and that becomes scripted and robotic, but it fundamentally mismatches what the people need in a certain, even if it's 1 or 2 degrees off, and that can throw the whole thing off. So you really have to, as I said, have this curiosity that's driving you that says, I want to find out what's unique about this situation.
Yeah, great point. And so let's start diving into it with that you believe, and I don't disagree with it, that sales training, and that word training we'll talk about specifically, mm-hmm. that sales training is broken. So let's start there. Give me your thoughts on why that is the case.
Well, I think it's fundamentally due to the difference between training and education. And yeah, I use this phrase, and I didn't originate it. I wish I'd been clever enough to, but it says, you know, you train pets, you educate people. And I think that's, yeah, fundamentally the difference is, you know, training's about compliance. And so, especially in sales these days, and mm-hmm. we're going to train you on our process. We're going to train you on our method. And we want you to use this method. We want you to use this process. And okay, fine. If everybody that you're talking to in terms of a customer on the customer side is exactly identical, right? From situation to situation, but they're not. And I hear this all the time from salespeople working for companies of all sizes saying, yeah, I've been trained within an inch of my life, but I don't know how to think.
Yeah.
And so what's the point? If you have a process, but you don't know how to apply it, you can't, you know, put it into context of the situation you're in, then it does you no good. And so this is where the education component comes in, is, you know, how do we continually reinforce training? It's not that training's bad, but it's episodic. And what we need to do is education is a daily occurrence. And it's not just sellers, but anybody in business has this obligation to say, how do I continue to develop my knowledge set, my skill set constantly, right? How do I do that? How do I make this investment? And that's really what I'm trying to help people with, is this idea of, okay, I have this responsibility to educate myself every day.
Get better and better what we do. And then I think what exacerbates that, of course, is, as you talk about it, I'd like to get your thoughts on, is that you say selling is changing. It certainly is not the same as when we were reminiscing back in the 90s. What are some of the examples of how selling has changed in our world today?
Well, I really think it's sort of the trappings around it that have changed. I mean, there's been this tremendous influx of these innovative sales tools, not the least of which is, you know, CRM systems, which give you the ability to, you know, track your customers' information that you exchange with them in ways that there wasn't easy before. And new sets of sales tools that track sales activity and, you know, customer engagement with your content and so on. But I think what people tend to overestimate is the impact of those changes today, right? And so there's this former scientist at Stanford, he's since passed away, named Roy Amara, who had this saying, Amara's Law, which is, you know, we tend to overestimate the impact of technology in the short term and underestimate it in the long term. And I think that's sort of the situation we're in sales today, is there's been this sort of golden age of innovation in sales technologies that can help you connect with customers, help you track, you know, your activities with customers and so on. But they fundamentally don't do anything to facilitate building a relationship with the customer, connecting with them, engaging their interest, inspiring their interest, and getting them to ultimately want to do business with you. Doesn't mean that we're not going to get there, but we're not quite there yet. So the basics, the foundations of successful sales are still about the relationship, still about the people. And where we're going to go to is that these technologies facilitate that, help you, help amplify your impact and your value, but we're not quite there yet.
Mm-hmm. What topic technologies are we talking about here? Are we talking about additional functionality that'll come in CRM systems that are going to help us do that better?
There's classes of systems. You know, there's what they call sales engagement platforms, which are really designed for your frontline sellers, who are basically your inside salespeople that are appointment setters for your account executives, mm-hmm. right? So your entry-level people. And these are, you know, effective platforms, way to sort of set a structure to run almost like a campaign, if you will, in order to proactively reach out and develop new prospects. They're pretty cool. But unfortunately, the way they're being used oftentimes now is companies aren't really changing the underlying behaviors of their salespeople. It's more automating what I call sort of bad behaviors. And one of the outcomes of that is it's not, yes, while it's generating, creates the ability to generate more top of funnel activity. It doesn't really do much perhaps in the way most companies are using it to affect the quality of the top of funnel. Mm-hmm. So you have a lot of sort of semi-qualified opportunities flowing through your pipeline that take a lot of time and result in relatively low close rates at the end. Yeah. So that equation needs to change, and it will, I'm sure, once we get accustomed and really understand how to use them.
Mm-hmm. And then related to, you touched on this, you say why the ability to be human is becoming even more valuable in sales.
Well, I think go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying, so do you think that, and in part technology, as you've just mentioned, maybe affected that, we hide behind it perhaps, but why do you think we have, and is that one of the things that has changed where now we have to be more human, and what does that mean, I guess, is where I'm stuck.
Yeah, well, I think that if you look at the context of what's happening relative to artificial intelligence, machine mm-hmm. learning, mm-hmm. Coming into business in general, but certainly starting to make its presence felt in sales, is that, you know, one thing the machines aren't good at, for instance, is empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that the decision to buy something is fundamentally an emotional decision. I mean, science has been irrevocable about that. You know, we make decisions for emotional reasons and we backfill the logic behind
right.
it.
Right.
Well, empathy sort of plays a really important role in that, to be able to, you know, see the world through as the customer does, is to be able to empathize with that and other emotional components. Well, you know, that's not where machines are strong right now. You know, where the automation or artificial intelligence comes in is going to be automating certain, you know, at least initially, rote tasks, routine tasks, to free up more time for sellers to be able to do the thing they're supposed to be good at, which is building the relationships that will lead to an order. But if you even look down further down the path, what authors and experts are looking at is that, yeah, you may see more AI involved in the selling process, but, you know, your machine's going to look just like anybody else's machine, right? So the ability to differentiate yourself is actually going to be based on being human as opposed to being more like a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And so the ability to bring the human characteristics into your interactions with your prospects and demonstrate the sympathy and other human soft skills, more critical. So people should be focusing on developing their ability to do that, because that'll make them stand out.
This is Henry Lopez. Let's take a quick pause on this episode to chat about your small business dreams. Do you have a great business idea, but have just not been able to get it launched? Have you built a successful corporate career, but need some help making the transition to entrepreneurship? Are you ready to start building your own wealth instead of someone else's? I invite you to schedule a free business coaching consultation with me. Just text BizCoach, all together, BizCoach, to 31996 for more information. I welcome the opportunity to chat with you about your business dreams and goals and offer the guidance and accountability that we all need to launch our first business. As an experienced entrepreneur who also made the difficult transition from the corporate world, I understand the challenges you're facing, and often it's about helping you ask the right questions so that you can make progress towards achieving your goals. I can help you through your transition to becoming your own boss. To find out more or to schedule your free coaching session, just text BizCoach to 31996 now. That's BizCoach, BizCoach, to 31996, or visit thehowofbusiness.com. So if I try to apply this to a solopreneur or a small business owner, is an example of that something like, for example, using a Facebook bot to try to qualify an interested person as opposed to a more personal approach? I'm trying to understand where there are examples of where small business owners are getting that wrong today.
Well, I think that bots are really useful, and we're going to see bots used more importantly, but you have to remember what the role is. The role of bots is this preliminary qualification.
Right.
Part of it depends on the complexity of your product you're selling as well, but mm-hmm. assuming there's some level of complexity to it that requires an interaction with a salesperson, is, yeah, the bots can help bring that person through the initial stages. But then you have to really do an excellent job of discovery and needs analysis and qualification or disqualification. And part of what we see with automation is actually almost too much in terms of activity into the top of the funnel. That's where before you might have said earlier, yeah, no, this one's not going to buy from us right now. But now we're going to automate a lot of that scoring, a lot of that sort of quantification or qualification even of the level of quality of this prospect. And So when you finally get that lead, you've got to be more discerning, not less. And we're sort of at the stage where we're a little less discerning about some of them. And partly because there are metrics that some companies set up to say, you know, we need to get a certain lead flow and there's certain ratios they're looking for that aren't resulting in better outcomes at the end of the day for the business.
Yeah. I think back to also, Andy, that some of our best positioning in the traditional before we had these technologies happened during some of that early qualifying. And it seems like maybe we miss out on that now. And that's part of perhaps what you're talking about, being more human. If I've got some automation or AI or tools that are emerging helping do that initial qualifying, I'm missing out on opportunities there to be more human, to be more empathetic, and to position. Is that fair?
I think, yes. Yeah, I think that's fair. But I think you can even reduce it further, which is say, you know, take an example is let's say you've been trying to reach out to a specific potential prospect and you know, statistics are, hey, you're going to make 7 to 19 touches, perhaps. You know, the studies are all over the map on this, but you're going to make multiple attempts to reach out to them. And so when you get this person on the phone, let's say, what you see oftentimes is that the seller is actually sort of keeping their eye on what's happening on their own phone, sitting on their desk. And so you've invested all this time and effort, and yet you might take your attention away for a couple seconds because you got a Facebook notification that something happened.
Okay.
And I've done these informal surveys when I do training for groups, and I'll say, you know, show me your hand if you will look at your iPhone or whatever that's sitting on your desk while you're have a conversation going with a prospect. And 100% raise their hands. And again, if you do look into studies, which I have about, you know, this idea of multitasking, we are completely incapable of multitasking as a species. So part of being human is, yeah, I'm gonna turn that phone off while I'm talking to, you know, if I got 2 hours, if you're a CEO, an entrepreneur, and you've got a few salespeople sitting, making cold calls, you know, they should be blocking that time out on their calendar dedicated to making their calls. And during such time, their phones are in their drawer turned off because they won't be focused. I tell the story all the time, but I mean, I don't know about you, but you know, I'm on the phone with my wife. She knows the instant I say, my email, right? As soon as my attention wanders, she knows.
And she knows.
And if you think your customers don't know, then you're fooling yourself. Mm-hmm. And so why? Just think how crazy it is. You've invested all this time and effort to get hold of this person, and then you let yourself get distracted by, you know, someone like your LinkedIn post. That's crazy. So that's part of being human, is being focused, being in the moment. And then another part is, you know, letting your curiosity out. We have this ability to gather so much information about people before we even interact with them, is we think we sort of know what they're going to say. You know, same thing true with all these marketing personas we create for our targeted customers. We think if we ask question A that we're going to get answer A. Well, we just go through the motions. We're not really curious about that person. And the way you make yourself interesting to a prospect is to be interested in them, right? And so part of being human is being curious and not assuming that just because you have a script of questions and potential answers, that that's what you should use. You should use it as a guide, but how do you be authentically human when you're talking to them?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense now. Those are great examples. And specifically, it goes to this question I want to ask you about from an entrepreneur or small business owner perspective. What do we typically misunderstand about effective sales? And you've given some good examples, but what else comes to mind as I look at this from an entrepreneur, a solopreneur, a small business owner? What else do you see often, Andy, that we get wrong about our sales effort, especially B2B sales?
Well, I mean, there's the obvious one that we think it's about the product, and it's really about the person. And that part really hasn't changed. And I think that we tend to overlook that more and more these days because there's just this assumption that, and I don't think these assumptions are necessarily valid, but there's an assumption apart, you know, you see in the sales world these days that, oh, our prospects are more busy. You know, no one answers their phone anymore, yada, 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 yada. And I can tell you from 40 years ago, no one answered the phone either. In fact, as I tell people today, it's, you know, unlike the yesteryear where, you know, I could walk into an office and ask a receptionist to talk to the CEO. And, you know, she'd dutifully write down the message. And then as I was walking out the door, I could hear her tear it up.
Right.
Right. You're never going to hear
it. That person didn't even have a phone. At least nowadays, they actually have a phone.
Right. But voicemail isn't going to make the decision yet, though it's potentially coming with AI. But voicemail isn't making the decision to you know, get deep six your message.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's still about you. And so I tell a story about early in my career when I was going in and cold calling the CEO of this big home building company in the San Francisco Bay Area. And I wasn't expecting to get the CEO, right? And you go into an office, you ask for it, but you don't expect to actually talk to him. But he was there. And he, courtly older gentleman, he was very nice. You know, I was less than a year into my career. I was 22. I looked like I was 16. And, you know, he takes me into his office and it's got this huge desk that's completely clear. And he sort of preempts me. And he takes, you know, from his top right-hand drawer, he takes out this deck of business cards, about three times the thickness of a deck of playing cards. But he sort of fans them out on his desk like a deck of playing cards. And he says, so, you know, these are all the computer salespeople that have called on me in the last year. And there were all my colleagues from my office were there and all my competitors. And he said, you know, I didn't buy from any of them. Why should I buy from you?
Mm.
And he wasn't talking about me, the company. He was talking about me. Why should you buy from me? And my answer was to myself was I had no freaking idea. I didn't know. You know, it had never been presented to me that way.
Right.
And it was such an eye opener. And I was extremely fortunate that he sort of started mentoring me over the course of a year. Because he was open to me coming back in and talking to him. And I sort of learned a lot from this customer. I ultimately got an order from him, but it was about me. And so, I don't know, a couple of years ago, somebody had sort of asked me a similar question about, you know, what, you know, are we making sales too complicated? Are we, you know, too much process, too many methods around it? So, and I said, well, perhaps. And I distilled down all my experience about how to connect and how to build a relationship and build trust with a person that can lead to an order down to four core skills. And I put them in an acronym I called BALD, B-A-L-D. And so the BALD method, if you will. And yeah, I firmly believe that if you can master these four core skills, then you can achieve almost anything you want in sales. And so the B of BALD stands for be human, as we just talked about. The A, ask great questions. L, listen slowly. You know, don't prejudge an answer. Don't, you know, don't let put your filters up. You know, don't let your script get in the way. And D is deliver value. And I just think that's the recipe. My experience has shown overwhelming. That's the recipe for building a successful relationship with a buyer or actually anybody in your life. Be interested in them. Be human. Ask great questions. Listen to the answers. And provide something of value.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not a whole lot more than that.
Yeah. And as you say, you know, sales is the promise to deliver value to your customers, right? That's what you're promising. So how do you answer the question now if you're asked, why should I buy from you?
Well, it depends on the context of what I'm selling, right?
Yeah.
But in my case, you know, I've built up this legacy that I believe people can trust about this perspective, how you use this BALD method, how you use the human skills to help customers go on this journey to buy something that will help them achieve the outcomes they want. You know, it's an attitude of service. And yeah, for me, that's, you know, as we're trying to get people to join the sales house, is this is what they're going to learn. You know, how to become more authentically human in order to achieve what they want, both in the short term and the long term.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if it was asked of me, and I've been asked of a variant of that question, I usually my answer was, well, I believe that what I have to offer is of value to your organization, and I am committed to making sure it's a successful project. So that's probably how I might have tried to answer it.
Yeah, well, I mean that commitment is important because again, people ultimately buy from you.
Mm-hmm.
But people are. You know, very self-interested, your buyers. And that's fine. They should be, right?
Right, right.
So they're trying to reduce the risk to themselves in order to make a decision that's a good decision for the most part. People generally aren't trying to make the absolute best decision. They're trying to make a good decision.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's, you know, the marginal return on your extra investment of time to make the absolute best decision usually doesn't pay back. And yeah, you're there to, if they really thought they could mitigate their risks and validate their assumptions by talking to a machine through a human, AI program, they would, but they don't. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of people assume that newer generations coming into the workforce or more digital natives, that they're going to be much more comfortable doing that. And that's going to drive greater penetration of technology, all the way to the decision point. And certainly for certain brands of products, it already has, right? You can buy many products online for a business that you couldn't 10, 15, 20 years ago. But when someone really has something at stake, when the person making the decision still has a career at stake, which oftentimes in complex sales, they do.
Right.
They're still going to want a person to talk to help validate that decision.
Yeah.
That's not going away.
Yeah.
What's not going to go away? It hasn't changed. It's not going to go away. Certainly in years of my lifetime, it doesn't mean, decades into the future that the technology won't, progress to the point it could. But, as far as I'm concerned, for the time frame I'm worried about, that's not going to change. And that's where this ability to stand out by being human becomes so important.
Yeah. And so your point is we overcomplicate the sales process because we lose sight of those things. We make it about, features and functions, perhaps. We overcomplicate it with all of these things. Maybe our tools get in our way, our methodology gets in the way, instead of it being what it's about, which is this human connection and building a level of trust with someone. Am I getting that right?
Oh, yeah. That's this whole idea of this BALD method is focus on that. Be human, ask the great questions. I mean, there's not much, like I said, there's just not much more to it than that. Is, every time you're interacting with a prospect, it doesn't matter if you're a solopreneur, it could be if you're an entrepreneur, because, oftentimes entrepreneurs take the lead in sales. I do for my own company, have for other companies I've worked for, is someone's investing some of their time in you or in your company, is what are you giving them in return? Mm-hmm. If somebody invests time in talking to you, what are they getting out of it? Yeah. And if they make that decision that they didn't earn a return on the time, there's no ROI for them, you're not going to get more time. That's simple.
Right. That's right. Yeah. All right. I want to go back to CRMs for a moment and your thoughts there further, especially for a small business. I mean, I think you need some kind of technology but mostly, of course, it serves management to make sure that we have a forecast of some sort and we can make our numbers. Just what if you were advising a small company, that might have, I'm talking about 5 salespeople in that range. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on CRMs overall?
Well, you should have one, right? Is you need this repository of interactions with your customers and your prospects. And I certainly, part of it's for the convenience of the company. I mean, salespeople come and go, but you should be able to have this record of what the interactions have been with the customer. But even for small businesses, there are more intelligent CRMs systems coming on online that, trying to provide more assistance in terms of reminders, in some cases even integrating sales advice at certain contexts that's able to sort of trigger. And they don't cost an arm and a leg, and it's worth having your salespeople start, if they're not already, being acclimated to this idea that there are tools that can help them proactively reach out more effectively to perhaps a broader swath of people in their target market, which might have taken them more time before, but now they could do in less time. They could help them organize their activities and provide them reminders so that it's not as ad hoc perhaps as it was before. And these are tools that, again, the goal ultimately is to say, how can they help you help the buyer make a decision?
Right.
But I think, the state of the art isn't quite there on some of those things, but it's this discipline is really worth having. And this is, and I wrote about this in my first book, is, this information is the company's information. It's not the salesperson's information. In the past, right? Salespeople used to take customers and clients with them and so on.
Yep.
And they would shelter, very carefully, shelter the information that they exchanged with their customers. Shouldn't let that happen. And if you're an entrepreneur and you get salespeople that are being lax about keeping the CRM system up to date, I mean, sometimes there are tools that can help facilitate that. Some of these engagement tools we talked about, but in the absence of that, you just have to have a zero tolerance policy. Is, you know, you want to work here, you're going to keep it updated.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks for those insights and thoughts on that. All right, you've touched on it already, but your thought on salespeople need to, you say, dramatically increase investments in their own development.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something else that has changed? I mean, you know, back then we used to go to the obligatory yearly sales workshop at kickoff and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What is it that to be good at it and to continue to get better and better at it that we need to do as individuals?
Well, back in the day, we would have bought our Zig Ziglar tapes and put them on our cassette player while we were driving between calls.
Right.
And we were sort of limited in the scope of things that we had access to. I mean, there were books, obviously, and there were lots of books, and read as many of those as I could. But, you know, now we've got videos, we've got podcasts, we've got, you know, this a range of resources available to us in many different formats, where the ability to you know, gain new information is so easy. And as always, it's always about the incentive or the motivation of the person to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And I stress it even more now because it is so easy to get access to this information, but you have to have this curiosity. And so, you know, I think it's always been the case for sellers is if they're ambitious, if they want to achieve certain things in their career, they inevitably confront this chasm, I call it, in their career between where they are and where they want to be. And I think one thing that's changed is since, you know, we see, you know, more and more employment in, you know, startups and technology companies and so on, is aren't as many of the sort of real formalized training programs that existed before to be able to help these people. And I think it was somewhat overstated how much they existed before. I mean, I 8 weeks of training my first year in the job with Burroughs, but I haven't had maybe more than 2 hours since then, right? It's all been on me to learn it.
Right.
And that's okay. I mean, we can rage against the machine, and Gallup has done polls showing that one of the primary drivers, reasons why salespeople leave companies is they're not getting the development opportunities from the company or their immediate supervisors. And that's certainly something that can be addressed. Companies could be more committed to creating true learning cultures that, you know, reward and incent and reward, you know, continuous ongoing education and develop personal development. Not many do in a serious way. So it's still up to the salesperson. And that's okay. I mean, that's just the way it is right now. So if you want to be able to achieve, you know, to the best of your ability, the great thing about today is there's so many more resources out there to help you do it.
That's right. All right. So speaking of the Sales House, your current firm, tell us about what you offer your clients.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the impetus for starting it was not just that it serves the great sort of summary my feeling of how I can help the broadest number of people at this stage in my career after 42 years in sales and a successful career. But hearing more and more from salespeople that they're sort of stuck. You know, they've sort of got the obligatory training, as you talked about, but that didn't really, that's that get them to where they want to be. And companies oftentimes just can't offer that type of assistance. You know, what we call the, you know, sales growth engine is what do I need to learn about, you know, how to make a build a relationship, how to do an effective discovery call, you know, the five key steps of qualification that really achieve the outcomes that I want. You know, how can I generate more revenue per dollar per hour, more revenue dollars per hour of selling time? I mean, that's fundamentally what a rep, you know, they may not think it quite yet in those terms, though they will eventually.
Sure.
Is, you know, how can we become more effective and productive? And they don't have that resource. Mm-hmm. So, that's what the Sales House is meant to be, is come spend 10 minutes a day. We've got courses, we've got live coaching, we've got hundreds of hours of content, instructional content, podcasts and so on, where you can come in and just spend 10 minutes a day and get smarter about, you know, whatever particular topic or aspect of sales that you want to get smarter in. And it's, for me, it's for this cumulative effect. You know, I look at my own careers with a little bit of training in the first year, but since that, you know, I sold, as I said, sold six continents around the world, sold everything from women's shoes to complex satellite communication systems. I decided to train myself how to do that. No one ever taught me how to sell to major accounts. I mean, I had to teach myself.
Yeah.
But that's okay. You know, the curious person's gonna do that. Yes, I had some mentors along the way that helped me, and that's a larger conversation we can have about that. But you have to take responsibility for it. And we're just that resource that somebody can come in. It doesn't really matter what stage of their career they're at, but if you're serving that, you have sellers and sort of that, you know, 3 to 15 year window where they're the most receptive to information, a perfect resource for them. We also have a number of people in their 50s and 60s. They're sort of retraining themselves.
Interesting.
Because maybe not even retraining as much as refreshing, let's say, oftentimes. Because I find people in that age group have a sort of good grounding in the basic skills, but maybe other people have lost faith in them because they're a little bit older. But you know, for me, that's really valuable talent that just needs to be refreshed and get out there, and they do fantastic jobs.
Yeah, very interesting. Great. Thanks for sharing that. All right. Books besides your book, is there a book that comes to mind that you would recommend?
Sure. I think for entrepreneurs, it's a great book, and it's not specifically for entrepreneurs, but I find it extremely relevant. It's called Barking Up the Wrong Tree. And it's written by a gentleman, a professor at UCLA, I believe, called Eric Barker. And it's the subtitle, something along the lines of, you know, why most everything you know about success is mostly wrong. And it's a great summary of a lot of the most current research about success and motivation and compassion and so on. And that very, very, very fascinating. And so I think it's, yeah, anybody that's in this business, one is succeed. It's got some things that are sort of counterintuitive in there that science has found that's well worth reading about.
Okay, great. Thank you for that recommendation. I had not heard of that book. And so we'll have a link to it as well as to your books on the show notes page for this episode at thehowofbusiness.com. All right, we can keep talking forever, but I know you've got a time commitment, so I'll start to wrap it up, Andy. What's one thing you want us to take away from this conversation we've had about B2B sales from the perspective of the entrepreneur or small business owner? What's one thing you want us to take away?
Keep learning, both as the entrepreneur, keep learning, and make sure the people that work for you are given the opportunity to learn. And as an entrepreneur, sponsor that learning and set aside time during the day for everybody to stop what they're doing, spend 10, 15 minutes reading a book, watching a podcast, listening to a podcast, watching a video, something where people learn together. And the message you send to your team is, we believe this is important. And as a result, people are going to say, well, I'm important. And I really like what they're trying to do here. And so you get greater employee retention, greater productivity. You know, why do you want to go out and train a bunch of new employees when you can just skill up the people you have?
Yeah, I think that's such a huge takeaway, because what I find myself and many entrepreneurs, small business owners, you're so busy with, you know, trying to keep the business alive and running and bringing in those sales or whatever it is that you're doing, that you don't usually make time for that.
Yeah. Well, and there's just this assumption that there isn't time, and there is time. I mean, studies showing that for decades, and this hasn't changed at all, is that salespeople spend about a third of their time actually engaged with prospects. Well, what are they doing the rest of the time? Well, there's preparation and so on, but there is time in there. Mm-hmm. There is time. And so spend that time. You know, well, I have a book club that a service I run for companies, and you know, the prerequisite is if they want me to do this for them, is they have to agree they're going to set aside 20 minutes in the business day for reading. And it's actually a 15 minutes of reading and 5 minutes of having the people write and reflect in a journal what they just read.
Okay.
And you know, it's a powerful tool, but it's a powerful message you're sending to your people.
That's right. That's right. Love that. All right. Where would you like us to go online to learn more?
So you can certainly connect with me on LinkedIn. Feel free to do that. That's the usual preamble, LinkedIn, /thesaleshouse. And then come to thesaleshouse.com. And then you can email me at andy@thesaleshouse.com.
Perfect. And we'll have all of those ways to get a hold of Andy on the show notes page as well, in case you didn't catch that. Andy, this has been a great conversation, insightful, a lot of things to think about, some great actionable tips, which I always love. Thanks for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, Henry, it was an honor, and thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Folks, this is Henry Lopez, and thanks again for listening to this episode of The How of Business. My guest again was Andy Paul, and we release new episodes every Monday morning. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and at our website, thehowofbusiness.com. You can also text the word BIZ, B-I-Z, to 31996 to receive more information.
Thank you for listening to The How of Business. For more information, links, and other resources, please visit thehowofbusiness.com.